This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Chef Ricky Moore's been chasing taste his entire life. Worked in kitchens in big American cities like New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Spent a lot of time in kitchens all across Europe, learning from Michelin star chefs. When it came time to open his own restaurant, Ricky went back to the foods of his hometown of New Bern, North Carolina. He's applying the same level of excellence at those highly rated restaurants to the country cooking of his childhood. And he's trying to change the way people think about North Carolina seafood. Ricky Moore is the owner, founder, and chef of Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham, also the author of the new Saltbox Seafood Joint cookbook. And he's here with us now. Welcome to the State of Things, Ricky Moore. Good to have you here.
Frank, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate you. Big fan.
I've been a big fan of your food for quite some time, just sitting outside that little shack on Mangum Street eating good fried fish. But tell us how it all started, because you moved around a lot, right? We talk about New Bern, but you did move around a lot.
Yes. Well, obviously, I come from a military family. I'm born in 1969. My formidable years were, you know, as a child, I lived abroad. Lived in Germany, and I was spending a good amount of time there, you know. And when I was there, you know, and obviously I was a small child, so don't remember all the details. But the one thing that I do remember is that, you know, it was definitely a culture shock. It was definitely a place that was a bit fascinating for a young person. Culturally, my mother and I used to take trips on the bus, and you know, it was a double-decker bus, you know, and we used to eat things like hinchin and pommes frites, and we used to go and visit our landlord, okay, because we lived on top of our landlord when we were there, and we used to go down and visit all the time, and she would take me, you know. So after I got out of school, I would be there, and there, another cultural thing that was pretty interesting is that, you know, they had Kinder beer, okay, and it was drank out of a specific glass. In addition to that, you know, it was the first time I had experienced, you know, like this dark rye, very powerfully flavored bread with beef tartare, okay, and that was, you know, presented to us, you know, as a snack, you know, and somehow I enjoyed it, you know. I can't recall the exact, you know, emotion or the exact sort of reaction to it, but obviously I enjoyed it based on what my mother told me. But yeah, wonderful experience. You know, being a young black child over in Germany, you know, and also being an army brat, you know, I was a little small, interesting kid with a big afro. And also I had one of my favorite sweatshirts on, which was a Fat Albert shirt. And my mother recalls some trips, you know, as we go out in the market or whatever, we would get on the bus and folks would touch my afro and they would say that it was, you know, to give good luck. You know, I mean, we didn't take it personally, you know, yeah. But it was just a really funny sort of quirky little thing, you know, because Frank, I had a perfect Michael Jackson afro. My mother made sure it was crisp every time we left the house.
That's great. So it probably did bring people a lot. And the food, I mean, you were aware of the fact, I mean, you were old enough by then and you had food, right, to realize that this was something different that you were eating in Germany.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was, you know, like I said, I didn't have any real reference points, you know, but there, you know, I was open to it, you know, and that was the good thing about it. I was open to receiving it, you know, even at that young age, you know. It was never like, oh my God, I don't want to taste that. Oh, yuck. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, being in the military abroad, you know, family, you're still in that bubble of the military installations. Yeah. So, but, you know, obviously, you know, you're in a different country and you go outside of that and you want to try to experience, you know, those things.
Now, the family did move back to, and for them, it was moving back to Eastern North Carolina, where they had a lot of family when you were 11 years old. So what was that like for you?
Well, moving back home was like, okay, I'm back home. I'm back to what's a familiar. I'm back to, you know, my strong family unit and my community. It was, you know, for me being one of the oldest grandchildren, you know what I mean? I grew up with my uncles and aunts, essentially, you know. We had a big family, and all of them were very sort of creative and musical and that sort of thing. You know, so it was cool to be around all these people and really learn from it and draw from their experiences where they were.
And both of your grandmothers worked, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Both of my grandmothers, both are domestics. Both of them were great cooks. Let me speak to that. They both come from rural environments, you know what I mean? They both come from having big families. They both come from this idea of having to provide for a lot of people. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, as for me, my understanding in all my conversations is that, you know, one pot cooking was a big deal. You know, it yeah. fed a lot of people, and you can, you know, you can spend, didn't have to spend a lot of money to do so. But the goal was to always make whatever was in that pot delicious. That was a really important thing. That's the most wonderful gesture, a soulful gesture that one could do for, you know, a group of people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that blend of economy, I've got to feed all these people, they've got to be healthy.
Right.
And it needs to taste good.
Absolutely.
You know? And to be able to do that over and over is a real act of love. What are your first memories of, or your memories of some of the finest food or the most enjoyable foods that you can remember?
Well, I mean, I would say I would define the food I grew up with was country cooking, you know, and that meant every family ate the same thing, you know, black families, white families, whatever family was there. It was a regional food. It was stuff like, you know, obviously pinto beans and ham hocks and greens and black-eyed peas and smothered chicken and chicken and pastry, you know, all these really country sort of dishes, you know, cornbread, obviously, hot water cornbread, greens with, you know, white cornmeal dumplings, you know, fish was always croaker, spot, you know, butterfish, hogfish, you know, and it was always fried, you know, it was never grilled or anything like that, you know what I mean? So I want to make clear that it was always fried.
And the bones were in it.
And the bones were in it, okay, the whole thing. And it was usually butterflied, and it was a specific time that we did it, you know. Yeah. You went to go fish yourself, you know, it was not always you going to a market, you know, even though, you know, if you didn't fish for yourself, there was always this person who came around in the neighborhood with a specific truck, and they had, it was like a fish truck, and he had a scale hanging off the back. I remember that distinctly. He would come around on Fridays, and he would have the fresh catch, and then he had ice on the truck and everything. It was very wholesome, and the idea of local was like understood.
Right, right.
Where else did you get it? You know what I mean? You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
So it was a fun thing, and then, you know, the food gatherings were always, you know, whether it be some sort of celebratory holiday or after church or doing a funeral or someone graduated or somebody just want to have a party or, you know, somebody got to pay their rent.
And your father's mother lived in rural areas. She lived in the country. I mean, you lived near the country, but you were able to see, you know, go to pick the, you know, get the eggs fresh from the chickens.
Yes.
And the hog slaughterings and all that.
Right. My father's mother lived out in Harlow. So that's right outside of Cherry Point, right outside of Havelock. And, you know, there was definitely rule there, you know. There was a time where, you know, I used to go and spend summers with her, you know, and I would have summer jobs harvesting tobacco, baling hay, digging potatoes, hauling poke wood. I mean, those people who are from East North Carolina, they know what poke wood did. That's hard work.
But what is that?
Basically, you're chopping up a bunch of wood and hauling it.
Okay,
pretty much, you know what I mean? And it was, you know, that type of work that requires, you know, a lot of stamina.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you know, there was a time where, you know, I used to go down there and, you know, it was still an outhouse. You know, there was still a water pump where you had to go to the well and get water. There was a smokehouse where they hung up all the hams. And also, you know, I guess hopefully we get to this point, but it was something that I learned early on in my professional career that my grandmother did, you know, way back when, is that she used to make sausages, and those sausages were packed in fat, okay, and lard. And moving forward, I learned, you know, this wonderful, you know, south of France sort of duck confit, which is essentially the same thing, you know, duck legs cooked in fat.
Yeah, 350% more expensive.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, it's just fat.
Yes.
And you know, and learning how to make the casings and keeping it all fresh and good.
Right.
And a real sense of order, too. I mean, both from the military family you were growing up in, but also their parents as well. There was a real kind of way you're doing everything.
Well, I guess when you have a big family, you have to be organized. You know, when you have responsibilities that require taking care of people, not only family, but other, not only children, but other family members, you know, there's an order to how we sustain. Sustainability has, in my mind, everything to do with being, have some sort of orderly behavior. You know, there's no way you can have some sort of longevity if things are sporadic.
Right.
You know what I mean? And also, that also helps in the idea of, you know, sharing that knowledge or sharing that behavior so that sustainability is fluid.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I think I received a lot of that, or indirectly and directly.
Well, we'll talk about how all of that made its way into your business when my conversation with Ricky Moore continues. He's the owner, chef, and founder of Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham. He also wrote the Saltbox Seafood Joint Cookbook. And we'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Chef Ricky Moore. He's worked in kitchens all across the U.S. and Europe. Came back to the food of his hometown, though, in eastern North Carolina when it was time for him to open up his own restaurant. And turns out that when Ricky wanted to be a chef, that's exactly what he did. But when he was younger, as a matter of fact, he wanted to be an artist. True enough. Tell me about your aspirations to art early on.
Well, I mean, that was something that was an activity that I really enjoyed. It's something that came very natural to me. You know, growing up, like I said, I had a lot of creative people around me, you know, and so somehow that bug got into me. The one thing, and two, I used to watch this little, I wouldn't call it an infomercial, but it was a program on maybe some public television, PBS, and they advertised, you know, you can draw this little, it was like a dough, you know, you know, you can send it in, you can get classes, you know, and I was very interested in that, and I did that, you know, and also the gentleman, Bob, with the afro, he used to say
Bob Ross.
Yeah. Bob Ross was a complete inspiration to me.
Yeah.
He had the ability to paint an entire piece of work in probably less than 30 minutes on the show, and it was fantastic. So that was one of the things that kind of inspired me. And like I said, it came natural to me. And so all through grade school and high school, that was what I did. That's what I was kind of known for. People knew me for my friends or what have you, and I really enjoyed it. And I was also inspired by, you know, teacher, Mr. Burney. And everybody knew Mr. Burney, but he was a fantastic art teacher. And he really kind of instilled in me, you know, what it meant to, you know, kind of pursue the talent that you have. Pursue
now you,
it.
You were thinking of doing that, going to art school at ECU.
Right. Right?
But you didn't
right.
do that. No. Why'd you change it?
Well, you know, Frank, I was in a place, you know, where I, you know, obviously evolved, and, you know, I felt like, you know, I wasn't going to be mature enough to go to college where I was at in my life then. I kind of felt like, you know, I needed something more adventurous, more meaningful. Frankly, I wanted to get away from home.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to do, period, in the story. And my father was a reference point to me, having been in the military for 20 years, you know. He had an example of what that looked like, and I saw some successes. I saw something in that. So, you know, during that time, the slogan was "Be all you can be," you know. So they showed all these commercials, and, you know, recruiters would come to high school, and I was like, you know what, that's an option for me, you know. And frankly, I can leave high school right away, start getting a paycheck right away, start, I had a place to live right away, mm-hmm. I could eat right away, I didn't have anything to hold me back, you know. So that was what I did, and it was a meaningful thing.
What was it like for you at first when you joined the Army?
You know what? I was pretty conditioned, you know, understanding that my father had been, so he briefed me a lot. You know, also from an athletic standpoint, you know, I mean, going through the basic training and the rigors of that was not really a challenge. Obviously, you know, having grown up in a military frame, understanding, you know, the behavior and the courtesies, you know. Basic training is an indoctrination. You know, once you go there, you know, you, first of all, you got to learn the courtesies and all that goes along with being a soldier, particularly in the Army, you know. And at 9 weeks, you know, you learn how to be a soldier. And it took a lot of time because you had to change a lot of people's behavior, you know, in those 9 weeks, you know, and then also create this harmonious unit of people who can take care of a mission and get it done. But for me, you know, I didn't have any real challenges. I think one of the things I also like to share is that, you know, I was kind of deemed maybe a shy person, possibly. You know, I didn't see that. I was just very reserved, you know. But, you know, there was a moment in time when I was in basic training when I felt, you know, a bit, you know, intimidated by the drill sergeants, you know, and how they engage.
I think that's their job, is it not?
Right, exactly. You know, okay. It was intimidating, you know, because they were very direct, yeah. Very, you know, orderly. But I would say this, you know, I got used to it pretty quickly because, you know, I grew up in a household where my mother, and I grew up with my mother, you know, she was a very direct person. Mm-hmm. She was very stern. She taught all her children, you know, that needed to be self-sufficient. You know, you need to be responsible. You need to be accountable for your actions. You know, I'm teaching you things. I need you to hear them. If you didn't hear them, she would make sure of that.
I'll repeat this.
Right. Until you see it.
Well, but you decided to become a cook.
Yes.
How come?
I think the idea was, you know, I went to jump school, all right? So I wanted to be a paratrooper, you know, we did the whole 11 Bravo thing. So I went to jump school, so I thought I was gung-ho. And then all of a sudden I felt like, you know what, I think it's important for me to kind of define what career I want to be in. And I go back to high school and I go back to my jobs I had throughout high school. I worked in a lot of places where there was food around, mm-hmm. Okay? You know, there was a class in high school. I took home economics, and I took it because, you know, all the girls were there. You know what I mean? And that was the motivation. But all of a sudden, you know, we were making meatloaf and mashed potatoes in this class. You know, so that was pretty cool. You know, a lot of my part-time jobs were cooking. Yeah. You know, so I decided to do it. And you know, was there a real definitive reason? I don't know, honestly.
But you had some advice, too, along the way that maybe this is, in terms of even military careers, not right. A bad place to start.
Right.
In terms
right.
of advancement.
Well, I would say that for me, the coaching that I received from my recruiter was, you know, outside of everything else, was that, you know, you can get promoted fast in this career. So that was the motivation. You know, I mean, you know, typically the cook in the military is not as glamorous or high tech or very impressive. But they needed people in the ranks.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the difference between Army cook and KP?
KP. Okay. when you were in KP, that was pretty much kitchen patrol. That means you did all the grunt work.
Yeah.
You did all the cleaning, the scrubbing, the peeling, the potatoes, the all the grunt work, all the stuff that, you know, nobody else wants to do.
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty much what KP is, you know. And a lot of times that was usually assigned to people that weren't traditionally cooks, you know, they were from other platoons, other companies. They needed help, you know, additional help. They would assign these people additional jobs. So
what does the chef do? Because, as you think about peeling potatoes, one of the things that tells you is you're using fresh potatoes.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's an important thing. You know, a lot of times the perception of military food is like, oh, we just take food and we slop it on a plate and you move along. No. It's very important that I share with everybody is that I learned a great deal about organization, quality control, customer service, how to cook for a lot of people at one time and deliver a quality product for not just two people, but for 2,000 people. You know what I mean? And it had to be good because that was the standard, you know. Just like in the civilian world, there was a commercial kitchen. They were leaders in that kitchen, and there was tiers of leadership. And everybody had to follow those regulations.
Yeah. Now, talk about the regulations because, you know, obviously any chef in any restaurant, whether it's commercial or military, has to be able to organize the work.
Right.
So that's one thing. And you can imagine the military, that's going to be a big part of your job.
Right.
The other part is sort of originality, coming up with your own stuff. Now, I'm guessing the Army has a way to cook that potato once it's peeled.
Absolutely. Well, here's the thing. There is a regulation that governs, particularly in the military, where in the armed forces. And that regulation, when I was in, I'll make sure I'm quoting, is a TM-10-412, which is the Armed Service Forces Recipe Guide. Okay, and that governed how you made things. And it was color-coded and number-coded. Okay, and all of these things would tell you exactly how much you need to make, what ingredients you needed, what number 10 can you needed, and all this sort of thing. There was even, Frank, a recipe on how to make Kool-Aid.
I see.
Okay. And those recipes were, just like I said, they were regulations. You know, they if you go outside of that, you know, things could happen.
But tear the packet from right to left and not left to right? Or
right,
how?
Right.
Yeah.
Put this amount of water in the container, stir it, and make sure it's dissolved, you know. But it was very much a creative process because there was tons of recipes. And there's someone higher up who would develop all these recipes, the nutritional value and everything, because it's important that soldiers, sailors, Marines, and everybody got fed correctly and wholesomely.
You've actually made a connection between the Army culture, military culture and food, and American food culture and the way they develop together.
Right, right. Well, I just think that, you know, if you go back in history, you know, there's a lot of the way we eat brands like Campbell's Soups, all these major companies, you know. The military really dictated how a lot of these brands began, you know, because there was something called a sea ration. The ability to store food in cans and have them have a long shelf life, you know, and things of that nature. You know, the infamous MRE, you know, this idea that you can have a ready-made meal ready to eat at 3,500 calories, and it was wholesome, and it sustained soldiers through combat, you know. Yeah. That packaging idea, you know, had to have helped a lot of these major brands, you know.
So for better and ill, we're living with it today.
That's right.
Were you at that moment now, again, this is a career, it's something to do in the military, you're interested in the military.
Right.
At any point, did you say to yourself, look, I think this is what I want to do when I get out?
Oh, absolutely. There was a point where I was, you know, working in a military facility and, like I say, you know, there was competition amongst all the other facilities on the post a lot of times, you know. So, you know, what we had, the equivalent to an executive chef would be the food service sergeant. And then you would have your sous chefs, which would be like, you know, first cooks, you know, or food service sergeants, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, we were competitions, you know. We would compete about, you know, oh, who's going to have the best salad bar today? Who's going to have the better desserts? Whose breakfast is going to be more fantastic? And throughout the military, you know, whether it be whatever branch, you know, during the holidays is where we had fun and we were very competitive and we did ice carvings. And so at that point is when I thought, like, hey, this could be a viable career for me. You know, I really enjoy the creativity of it, the artisticness of it, the camaraderie, you know, the team effort to do something. So that's kind of when it popped for me. You know,
and the organization, which had already played to some of your strength. The
absolutely
idea that you can pull all this together and do it for 2,000 and not just 20.
Yeah.
You also met your wife, Norma, while you were in the Army, right?
Absolutely. My love of my life. Norma, I hope you're listening. We met in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii. And it was a whirlwind 6 months, and we were married. And it was fantastic, and we've been married for 28 years, and we have two beautiful children, Hunter and Grayson. And she was also comes from a family, fisherman family. Her grandfather fished.
Oh. And you went back to the East Coast then. When were you still in the service when you went back to D.C.?
No, not at all. No, not at all. I got out when I was in Arizona.
Okay. So, okay. But you did, you and Norma then went to D.C. for a while, lived there for a while?
Yes.
What brought you there?
Norma and I, when I got out of the military, I got out it was in a Presidio in San Francisco. Norma had been stationed in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. Okay. And I met her there. And she got out from there, and then we drove all the way up to Hyde Park, New York, from Arizona. And she went to SUNY in New Paltz, and I went to CIA.
Okay, Culinary Institute of America.
That's correct, Culinary Institute of America. And it was just a time where we spent, and I had a wonderful time there. Going to school was motivated by one of my chief warrant officers when I was in the military. And that was a time where I said, okay, I'm going to make this a career. And so he gave me that option, and I researched, and then I said, well, okay, this all makes sense because, hey, this school, which was known right now as the Harvard of Cook Schools, was started by GIs coming back from World War II. So it all made sense to me, you know.
What did you learn? I mean, again, you had experience eating good food,
right,
making it on on a scale.
Right.
What did you learn there?
I learned the how and the why and the craft of cooking. I learned the historical reference as it pertains to classical a cuisine, which is referenced from French from a French standpoint. And the one thing that I learned that was also wonderfully surprising is that, you know, Gustave Scoffier, which was, you know, the guy who wrote Le Guide à Culinaire, which is the reference point to all professional cooks in terms of fundamentals of cooking. Okay. And he was in the military. He was in the French army. And he structured the classical kitchen in the same style as one would do in the military. You know, there was structure. So you start off with, you know, things like people like your commis. They did all the grunt work, mm-hmm. okay? And then you had the chef de partie. Chef de partie were usually the line chefs, the chefs mm-hmm. who worked the line. And then you had the sous chefs, the intermediate leaders between the chef de partie and the chef. And then you had the chef, and then you had the chef de cuisine, the executive chef, and then the restaurateur. So it was all organized in a military fashion, which I knew very well.
You did a lot of research on the individuals, too. You were in the library an awful lot.
I spent so much time, Frank, in the library. It was so, for me, it was CIA. My CIA experience was invaluable, okay, because, like I said, I knew how to cook. I knew how to make things taste good. But what I didn't know is the how and the why and the history. And for me, if you're going to be good in your craft, you have to know your history. You have to know who were the influences, why we do things, why we did this, what was this all about, who started this. So I spent tons of time in the library, tons of time in the media center, because there was now all of a sudden there was a video on how to bone out a chicken or bone a fish or make hollandaise sauce, you know what I mean, or make these classical dishes that, you know, I would never know anything about. So it was fantastic.
Why French, do you suppose, now that you say it? Why is that a reference point?
Well, I mean, that is the... As it is written, even though we know there is tons of civilizations that started cooking way before the French, you know, the bottom line is they put it in context. They put it in a reference. They wrote mm-hmm. it down.
Yeah.
They put it in some sort of order so that there is some sort of reference to build upon, you know. And it's a wonderful thing to know, even though, you know, we obviously know the civilizations that were cooking way before right. then, and there's techniques and things like that, but still, they were the ones who put it in a box form or a package so in which to follow.
You took that education. You started working in some of the biggest cities in America cooking. Talk about your early experiences as a chef.
Well, I mean, my goal was very defined. I was going to spend time in the fine dining space. I wanted to be, you know, work in all the fine dining restaurants and spend time in Michelin-starred environments. And the reason why is, you know, because, you know, like during that time, you know, there was a time where chefs were deemed as domestics, you know, in 1977, you know. Yeah. And for me, as I study and paid attention to a lot of others who came before me, I wanted to spend time, you know, saying, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to spend time in a professional realm. Fine dining was it, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to do fried chicken. I didn't want to do collard greens. I didn't want to do cornbread, even though that's the stuff I grew up on. I didn't want to do that. That wasn't the path, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I decided, you know, I wanted to stay there. And a lot of times, Frank, I think about it too, is like, well, you know, did I subdue my culture? Did I subdue for things I grew up on? But no, it wasn't the case. It's just a time where I wanted to explore some different things. You know, that's what it was all about.
Including the kitchens of Europe. What did you learn there?
Well, I learned culture. I learned that one of the reasons is on the path to being, you know, working as a fine dining chef, you know, everybody takes this pilgrimage to Europe. Okay, and the reason why is because you want to understand what makes all these people, all these establishments and institutions and places that have been around for a long time great. Why is this place a Michelin star? Why is this place this? Why is this chef this? And what I found was is that there's a cultural behavior. There's a behavior that goes along with restaurants in Europe and how they hold their culture and their cuisine to a level of reverence, you know, and it's years of history behind a lot of the things, and it's very real rooted, you know, and that's one thing that attracted me, and the one thing that I try to understand, like, okay, so, look, food can only be so good. Like, what makes this better? Mm-hmm. What makes this something different, you know, and that's what I found is it's a culture of behavior. It's the way, you know, in specific societies and specific areas, they spend a lot of time cultivating their cuisine. They take great pride in it, you know, and it's very traditional.
Now, some would say that pride and that posture and tradition leads to a kind of an arrogance.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. And you know what? That's something that I believe, you know, it could totally be perceived that way, But, you know, extract that, you know, and extract and look at me as a young cook wanting to learn. For me, I moved that out of the way. Mm. And I say, you know what? I understand. Okay, I'm accepting that. You can look at it as pompousness or you can look at it as pride, extreme pride, maybe a different pride you have never experienced. Mm. You know, and for me, I can, a lot of times people would probably perceive me as such, that a pompous. But no, I'm just very serious about what I've learned and the craft that I've spent so much time, you know, being disciplined in. So, yeah, I'm going to speak to it with a level of reverence that may come across pompous at times.
We are going to talk to Ricky Moore. You be the judge, but I'll tell you what, if you've ever eaten at the Saltbox Seafood Joint, you might just suspend that judgment for a moment and just talk about the food and talk about how you brought that tradition, all of that European tradition, back home to New Bern, North Carolina, and then to the rest of the state. When my conversation with Ricky Moore continues on The State of Things, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Chef Ricky Moore today, owner and founder of Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham. Traveled to kitchens of the United States and Europe, learned from the great chefs, and then applied all of that to his knowledge, all that knowledge and experience to the taste of his hometown of New Bern, North Carolina. Also the author of the new Saltbox Seafood Joint cookbook. So we've got you in Europe now, and you've been all over the United States. You're taking in all this information about the structure and the history and the tradition.
Right.
These great European chefs. You come back. Now, you lived in D.C. then for a while, right?
Yes, yes. I started my career in the Washington, D.C. area. And the reason why is because Norma, my wife, she's from the area. All her family's from that area. Who settled in that area, exactly. But, yeah, started my career there and started off in a restaurant called Galileo. Galileo was a restaurant that was owned by a gentleman by the name of Roberto Donna, and that was my first job coming out of the Culinary Institute of America. Fantastic time. Learned Piemonte region of cooking, you know. The idea of as I move through kitchens, you know, particularly there, I try to make the association of food I grew up eating. You know what I mean? That was really important to me. That's how I learned. I learned that way. If I worked at a restaurant, I wanted to, first of all, go and see how they work. So we would do things like a stage, you know, which you go in and work for free.
Uh-huh.
You know, just to, sort of, it's part of the interview process, if you will, you know, and I would go and see if it made sense to me, if it spoke to me, the style of cooking, the cuisine. So that was my first job coming out of CIA.
Okay, so eventually you did leave D.C., and you ended up coming back to North Carolina. What brought you to North Carolina again?
Well, after spending time in D.C. and spending time in Chicago, my wife and I decided, okay, you know, D.C. is getting a little bit too overwhelming now. You know, and we had spent a good amount of time there as well, you know, and we decided, okay, let's relocate. And we relocated to North Carolina, my home. And my home in particular is New Bern, but we decided to settle in the Triangle because it just made sense for the both of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And the goal was when we moved back to North Carolina, you know, it was important that thought about opening my own business, but I kind of took a step back and said, okay, I'm not ready for this yet because I don't understand the market yet. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what's going on here in this market and what I needed to do and that sort of thing. So I took some jobs, you know, just so that, you know, I can kind of get a feel of it. And one of the first jobs that I took was a place in Carrboro called Glass Half Full. Okay. And some wonderful owners there who gave me an opportunity. And when I moved here, you know, just like I've always done, you know, I cook for the owners at their house, you know, and I did a wonderful sort of Indian meal. So I made homemade naan and we made all that sort of thing. So, you know, obviously they were impressed, you know, and I really appreciate them giving me the opportunity. And so that's where I started when I first got here. And I took on some other jobs, you know, and then I decided, well, you know what, now I am ready to open up my own business. And I had understood the market a little bit better. I've been in it for a while. And I decided that it was important to me that I do something that I could scale, something that was simple enough where I can take, you know, all of what I know as a professional cook and put it into this one simple, you know, sort of concept, you know, and that's what I did. So I started to put on my military recon hat and started doing little recons around town, whether it be in Raleigh, Chapel Hill, or Durham, or Hillsborough, you know, just to understand, you know, and I started looking around and I saw this little place, and it was very reminiscent of a little small place I grew up going to, but also, you know, I also took a trip to Singapore. And in Singapore, I noticed one of my favorite places to eat. Okay, my favorite places. And they had what they call these hawker centers or hawker stalls. And basically, it's an open-air market, you know. And it's a lot of little small places where one individual cooks something really delicious. That's all they do, you know. And I drew inspiration from that, you know. And so I said, well, if I can find me a place that's small that I can kind of put together, then it'd be lovely, you know. And I was in a place too, Frank, where it's important that I began this apprenticeship to entrepreneurship. You know, all of what I knew as a professional cook, it's the same thing. I did the same model. I started off and I learned from different people. So I decided I want to do a project that was similar to that. And so I found this little place on Mangum Street here in Durham.
I mean, it's a shack.
Yeah, by definition. It is a 205 square foot space.
Yeah.
Okay, a lot of people's bathrooms are bigger than that. Okay, but I decided that that was the place to do this idea. Now, I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I was going to do seafood or not. I really didn't. Mm-hmm. It was just a very sort of a, I was always, I use the term locked and loaded for any opportunity that came before me. Okay, I was prepared for it. You know what I mean? So I looked at it, and in my mind, my wife asked me one day, where can I get a good fish sandwich from? And I didn't have an answer for her. And so that sparked the idea. So that's when I said, okay, I'm going to do seafood here. Okay, it looked like a little seafood joint on the side of the road, mm-hmm. something you can go to the beach, you know, and kind of hang out with or whatever. So that was it, you know.
But now, I mean, that's, see, on the one hand, you know, when you say, hey, nobody's doing that,
right.
you think, well, that's an opportunity, but there may be a reason nobody's doing that. It's kind of scary, right?
That's right. Well, I think that's the chance that I took. That's the chance that I was ready to manage through prior to, you know, opening Salt Box. It was important to me that I understood how to sustain myself if things didn't work out. You know, being able to embrace failure, that was really important to me. And with the support of my wife, Norma, we decided, okay, we're going to see this through. And look, Frank, I was very confident in my skill set. I'd ran a lot of businesses. I know how to make money with food. I know how to cook. I know how to make things taste good. So I had everything I needed to be successful. I just needed to take the leap.
Well, and it turned out it was pretty much a success right off the bat.
Yes. I mean, in the beginning, there were some challenges. I would say that, you know, the first 3 years, there were challenges. It's like any other business, you know. Yeah. We had to work through things. I had to sustain myself. I had to convince people to come to that part of town to come eat fish outside in the cold.
Yeah, because there's no inside. Those 250 square feet are just that's your cooking.
Kitchen.
And then there's some benches.
Right.
And Mangum Street, which is kind of a busy street. Isn't
Absolutely.
It? Not exactly like a little country road I can pull off and have some fried fish.
Not at all. So it was a challenge even with that, having to draw people there and get them there. And all of a sudden, in addition to that, you know, the cultural condition of people knowing seafood as flounder, shrimp, and oysters.
Yeah.
They don't know anything about bluefish, mullet, mackerel, butterfish, sheep's head, none of that sort of thing. So that was another challenge.
And eating fish with the bones in them.
Absolutely. But particularly the fish and the bones in it. You know, I grew up eating that stuff, so, you know, bonefish is my thing. But, you know, I figured it out. I worked at it. I didn't give up on it. You know, I had a specific vision, and I stuck with it, even though I took some hits here and there. And it turned out nice.
You are also on a mission to educate people in North Carolina about seafood and about North Carolina seafood, the sustainability of our coast as
Right. Well, one of my indirect missions outside of running my business is absolutely. North Carolina is, from a food standpoint, from a culinary standpoint, or a regional food identifier, we're known for barbecue, okay, which is... I'm okay with that. I grew up eating it, too. I love it, okay? But I think we got 101 miles of coastline, and I believe we should be celebrated in that arena as well, okay? You know, you think about, South Carolina with shrimp and grits. You think about Maryland with crab cakes and crab. Where? What about us?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know.
Well, and learning about all those other fish, you know, I signed up with the Walking Fish Co-op when it first came into existence, and I've been signed up ever since for I don't know how many years.
Wonderful organization.
An amazing organization, a cooperative of fisher people who bring whatever it is, like a CSA, once a week, and you eat it, you know.
Right.
And so I learned about trigger fish and black drum and mullet and things I didn't know about.
Right.
And once you learn how to cook it, it's all great. But I would never have known about it had I not taken the plunge.
Absolutely. And that's a wonderful segue, Frank. That's what I wanted to do and made sure that I did is, like, these are native species, not trash fish. That's one thing I really was really important to say. This is native stuff that we should be eating. And I know people ask, well, how do things taste? Well, it's not really a taste. It's more of a texture and a flavor profile. It's not really always, it tastes like this, tastes like that. You know, you got your oilier fish, your mild fish, and your what I call full-flavored fish, or fatty or rich, and you have your steak-like fish. Those are the categories, okay? Right.
And knowing how to cook them it sounds like the cliche, you know? It depends on how you cook it, right?
Absolutely.
But it really does.
Absolutely.
Which is why, perhaps, one of the reasons you made a cookbook.
Yeah. How did that happen? It came through osmosis, maybe? Yeah. Organically? No. I felt it was a need to do this, you know, and I took the same approach that I did with my business with the book, simplicity. You know, I wanted to make sure that when I wrote the cookbook, you know, it was important that, you know, people wouldn't find it intimidating. It's not meant to be a chefy book. It's not meant to be it's meant to be used in the kitchen. Okay, the recipes are simple. They're straightforward. It teaches, the species and what's at our coast and the flavor profile over there and the textures and that sort of thing. So that was kind of the premise of the book, you know. It needs to be, for me, the recipes are forward. It's not about me, you know, even though I share my story so that you deem me an authority on what I'm talking about. Right. It's important that we get in our kitchens and start cooking some local North Carolina seafood.
Well, and learn about these species and understand that with a little bit of, ingenuity, all of these things can come out kind of great, but you do have to know which ones to broil and which ones to fry
and
which ones to chop up.
Absolutely.
So it's long overdue, and that's good. And you built the business. You said you wanted to scale it, and you've got more than just that shack now.
Yeah, absolutely. I have my original location, which is located on Mangum Street, and then I have my second location, which is indoor dining plus picnic tables over on Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard, and I also have a food truck.
It's all there. Yeah. And you're the host of a new special on UNC TV called The Hook.
Yes, yes. That was in conjunction with Black Public Media and Marquee Media. It's a show that speaks to exactly what I've been doing with Saltbox, you know, the cultural piece around the fish fry on our coast. And also, I like to deem myself the evangelist of bonefish, because I think that is a true sustainable species right now, you know, and it's because a lot of people don't eat it.
Tell us more about bonefish.
Well, bonefish, things like, I grew up, you know, eating this stuff. I never had a fillet fish growing up, so it's like croakers, spots, butterfish, hogfish, you know, some trout, you know, all these sort of things. These are things that are small panfish. And you typically either, where I grew up, they were always fried. But you can grill them, you can smoke them, you can do whatever you want to like to them. But I just feel like if we eat more of that, there'll be more of the other fish that we truly enjoy.
Yeah, and take your time and work around the bones and
absolutely.
Enjoy it and talk with your family. And
absolutely. Yeah,
time.
I think a lot of times, too, you know, we're a lot of other cultures now, they take pride in their fish that serve whole.
Yeah.
And we don't. Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it's important that
spend more. I got to ask you this now. How about air fryers?
And fry what?
Fish? I had to ask you.
There's an oxymoron. Air fryers.
You can't do it. Is there any fish at all on the face of this earth that would work?
Oh, my goodness.
Your answer.
I can't even speak to it, man.
Got your answer. Let's talk about suppliers, though. Sustainability and ecosystems. There's two key ecosystems that are important for any life on Earth.
Right.
Obviously, the environment, which, you know, we can talk about that in the coast.
Right.
But also the business environment, suppliers and wholesalers and processors. What's that picture look like in the state of North Carolina for a sustainable fish industry when you think about going up the supply chain?
Well, I'll tell you, that is a huge conversation. For me, I can only speak to it from a restaurant whose main item on their menu is a sustainable product, seafood in particular. You know, there are fishermen out there who have been doing it for years. And as years go past, there's been challenges, you know, from whether it be a natural standpoint or some other regulatory issues that are challenging. There's a lot of us, including myself, who are out there sort of promoting the idea of really buying from North Carolina fishermen. Really important. I want to make sure that I speak to this. You know, Saltbox would not be if it wasn't for a North Carolina fisherman. Period. End of story. That's how I base my whole restaurant off of, you know, this native species, this what I like to call El Terroir, which is the food of my region, you know, and it was really important that I never forget them, because as hard the work that they do to bring this fish in is just incredible.
But the first step is bringing it in, but then it's got to be processed. It seems, right. Is that a missing link right now?
Well, I would say if I had my wish list, I think there should be a huge processing plant down in the coast someplace. You know, I mean, right now, when the fish comes in, I process it myself, you know, but that's a specific skill set that a lot of people don't have. Right. So, you know, yes, I deem there could be an opportunity there for the fishermen to not burden the fishermen too much than they already are, catching it and going out and getting it and dealing with the elements. Have some place where it can be brought to and processed and organized.
It's an economic development opportunity. If you had a cooperative business where people are all sharing in the profit, that would be even more wonderful, because the money stays right there.
Absolutely.
And it does sound like a need. So what about Saltbox? Are we going to expand? We've got two stores now and a truck.
Yeah. The goal is to expand regionally. So, you know, I got two in Durham, and I want to have one in Chapel Hill at some point and one in Raleigh. And then I want to steadfast, you know. I'm very much a person who likes to move very organically, very controlled, and very organized. Yeah. So that would be the goal.
All right. We will stay tuned. Ricky Moore, owner, founder, and chef at Saltbox Seafood Joint in Durham. Also the author of the new Saltbox Seafood Joint cookbook, and going to be at Golden Fig Books in Durham. That's on November 19th at 7 o'clock. And we said the UNC TV special is called The Hook, and that's available at the UNC TV website. And all of that information is at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.